give a New York welcome to John Beckett.
Good afternoon, everybody. So I was asked for that story 2 minutes ago, and it was the only thing I could think of. So I said, I'll tell this story. And it was actually, my dad said, I'll only give you the kidney if you keep it in the condition it's accustomed to being in. So you got to keep it in red wine, basically. So, and I found out that the drinks reception was actually last night. So, like, how many Irish people miss a drinks reception by 24 hours? That is just careless on my part. But as you heard, Bonin has been a little bit delayed, so he's going to be along now shortly. But in the meantime, I'm going to kick off and talk a little bit about connected devices and artificial intelligence. So I run a company called ChannelSight. It was founded 4 years ago. And what we do is we work with big brands, publishers, and broadcasters to help them to monetize the digital content that they're pushing out and to track the performance of different campaigns that they're running based on what sales are generated in the channel from those campaigns. Now, part of what we do means that we see an awful lot of campaigns, we capture an awful lot of data about what's going on with those campaigns across all sorts of different devices, platforms, markets, and etc. And as a result, we get to see some really exciting emerging trends. So that's what I'm going to talk about now for a little while until Bonin arrives. So first of all, artificial intelligence, we all have a lot of different opinions and ideas about what that actually means. But for a brand, is it a friend or a foe? Now, that's a difficult enough question to answer because there's a lot of different kind of factors that play into that. But I'm going to play a video to kind of show you where my mind started with this when I first thought of the subject of artificial intelligence. So it's not exactly the Terminator, right? But that is artificial intelligence coming along really quickly. But if that's where we are, we don't have a lot to be worried about. They're not exactly going to take over the world in the short term, right? But when it comes to AI, something like a connected smart fridge is significantly more threatening to brands than the Terminator, right? And that's what I'm going to talk a little bit about today. So how is that the case, or why is that the case? So we've got the second video here. It goes on for about a minute, but it's by a guy called Professor Scott Galloway. Many of you might have heard of him, of L2 Digital. Really smart guy, I have a lot of time for him. He does some great talks. And this is one example of connected devices and people, how people are engaging with voice assistants and connected devices. So you might play that video there, please.
Alexa, buy batteries.
Amazon's choice for batteries is Amazon Basics. AA batteries, 48 pack. It's $13.60 total, including tax. Would you like to buy it?
No.
I also found a 20 pack of Amazon Basics Triple Performance Alkaline batteries. It's $7.61 total, including tax. Would you like to buy it?
No.
That's all I can find for batteries right now.
So, Alexa, knowing that you don't have the visual cues of other brands, has decided to tell you that Amazon private label batteries are the only batteries available, despite the fact there are numerous brands available on Amazon.
So I don't know if everybody was able to hear what Alexa was saying there, but to summarize, he asked, I want to buy batteries, and it recommended only two types of batteries, the Amazon Basics batteries. And then when he said no, very loudly, that he didn't want either of those batteries, it said, that's all, Alexa said, that's all I can find. Even though there was Duracell and Energizer and lots of other batteries on Amazon. So what does that actually mean for brands? If you're a brand and you see people using voice devices and connected devices more to order products, and you're not even getting a look in because Alexa isn't even mentioning that you exist, how do you compete with that as a brand? And that should scare you to your very core, because if you're not where you need to be, what do you do? So if you look, first of all, at the number of voice-connected devices. So I don't know if you can see all the numbers and stuff, but basically there's about 25 million voice-first devices being shipped this year, and it's on an exponential growth curve there. So this is not a problem that is getting that is going to go away. This is a problem that is growing exponentially for those brands, or for all brands. Now, when you look at that voice-first device footprint, but then look at the number of connected devices that are being shipped as well, these are also growing exponentially. So we're further back down here at 20 million devices, but look at where that's going over the next 5 to 10 years. So what does this mean for brands, and what can brands do about this issue? And more importantly, as artificial intelligence begins making buying decisions for us, how do we compete with that, or how do we adjust what we're doing to that new paradigm? Because we're going to look a little bit about how that happens and why devices are now beginning to purchase for us. So this is a project that we worked on in Channelsight with a company called Friesland Campina. They're a big dairy company. They're based in the Netherlands, about 16 billion euros revenue. And what we did is we took advantage of what you just saw with Scott Galloway there talking about Alexa in order to build a completely voice-activated shopping experience. So on the left here, you have a fridge with a camera in it. This is a special camera. It's a Siemens fridge, and it identifies the actual products in the fridge, the quantities remaining of each item, etc. Then you've got an app. It's a Home Connect, a Siemens Home Connect service. And it's Frico Cheese is who we also ran this. It's a Friesland Campina-owned brand. So what did we do? We connected we used the same model that we used with Scott there to connect and make an artificial shopping experience for the user. So let's say you have a smartwatch or you have Alexa, you say to Alexa, what's in the fridge? And Alexa will say to you, look, you've got some chicken and you've got some cheese and you've got some various bits and pieces. And you say, okay, well, what can I make with those ingredients? Alexa, we referenced a popular recipe database for the most popular recipes that we could find, and based on those ingredients, and then fed that back to the user in the form of the three recommended recipes that they could prepare with those ingredients, along with a summary of, you also need, by the way, an extra three ingredients, and would you like to buy those now? And then it could also interpret things like, yes, and we're also eating for six, so you'll need to adjust the quantities of all the ingredients, and actually just buy all of that for me and get it delivered, and I need it there in an hour. So with no input from the user visually, now we ended up sending it so that we could send the videos of the recipe back to a smartwatch or a phone as well, but with no required visual input for selecting the ingredients, somebody was able to select a recipe they liked the sound of based on the ingredients they already have in their fridge and place an order for the missing ingredients that they could then, that would work. And this was a live proof of concept that actually worked. So this is an example of something, taking the batteries example in Amazon and bringing that into the real world in a more structured way, that's what that looked like. We also then went on to develop some personalized video. So let's say you've gone through that use case that I just went through, you know you've selected a chicken pie as your product or your recipe that you want to make. Then we were able to get it so that it would automatically personalize a video to you and then make that available automatically to download, so you'd get instructions on how to make that recipe sitting on your iPod in your kitchen when you came home to start making the recipe. So this, and then again, this was all automated. There's another short video that this goes on for about 3 minutes, and we're only gonna play a few seconds of it. But you can see, yeah, click play there, please.
Hi, John. Welcome to your own Freecode recipe collection.
Okay,
and today, right, we're using one of your favorites. It's really easy to make your favorite sandwich at home with a special...
Okay, I actually have a button in my own hand. But that's basically how it's working. So we've gone very simply from being able to order, decide on the product, order it, through to have instruction video, all fully automated, no manual intervention whatsoever, and at scale. So we can push these out. These videos can be customized with colors, with backgrounds, with ingredient types, different visual shots, all from stock photography and stock video, and personalized for individual users. So really cool use case, and this is the kind of model that we use that I talked about, starting with the user talking to Alexa, connecting to the fridge, connecting to the recipe database, and then pushing out the entire thing out for delivery. Looking at the purchasing path, this is something you're going to be very familiar with, but this is the traditional purchasing path. So a user begins at the left-hand side, is influenced by an event, usually an advertisement of some sort, and then moves through to hopefully buy the product and have loyalty at the other end. Now, as we all know, that this linear purchasing path is now very different, and it's more like this, where you have many, many linear purchasing paths, all based on different things. So maybe it's looking at Facebook, maybe it's seeing an ad, maybe it's watching a video, maybe it's an out-of-home advertisement, maybe it's a combination of all of these, that the user builds up a picture of what they want to do, and then at some point in this process develops a buying intent. So they might never develop a buying intent, or they might develop it after one of these interactions, or it might take a number of them. But either way, as a brand, what do you do to make sure that at any point you are influencing the user so that they can buy the product once they have that buying intent? And what if that buying intent is developed by a device that the user has, like their fridge or Alexa, rather than through a traditional engagement like looking at a video directly or looking at an out-of-home advertisement? So if you look at how this has evolved, this is actually a massive change, and it's the first ever real change that there's been since the days of hunting and gathering. So back, even if you look at how people buy in a store, they walk into a store, they take an item off the shelf, they put it in their trolley, and they walk out, they pay, and they walk out. That is only sophisticated hunter-gatherer behavior, right? You're not knocking something over the head and dragging it back to your cave, but it's basically the same thing, right? Now, when we got onto internet shopping, again, nothing was fundamentally changing about what we were doing. And even when you look at Prime, where you're subscribing to things that you don't really want to think too much about buying, maybe bleach for your kitchen, you know, how much time do you want to put into thinking about bleach? But it's still just a subscription. So if you don't need bleach or you're going on holidays, you need to turn that subscription off. What we have now is, for the first time, is a fundamental shift in how people are buying things, because you have robots or artificial intelligence or devices making decisions, predicting what you want to buy, and then making that buying decision for you. So every one of us has a profile on, say, Amazon, and Amazon is going to know more and more about us. So for example, some people may want the Amazon's basic product. Other people might want the premium product that they always go for, the expensive premium product. Or sometimes there's going to be massive variations of that. Some people might not want the expensive bleach, but they might want the expensive bread, right? So everybody will have their own profile, and the algorithms will decide what product it thinks we want based on previous purchases and overall profile. So where you have, as a brand, are talking to algorithms rather than people, how do you do that? How do you compete, and how do you advertise to a robot? So if you look at how you can influence an algorithm, it comes down to six or seven things that are really key. First of all, knowing your consumer and building that profile out. So who are you targeting? Nespresso does this brilliantly. And if you look at, they have the CRM, they have the clear visibility over what all of their customers are buying. They have very clear recommendations that they make to people when they are engaging with them, sending out promotions to them. But they have that, they're capturing so much data about what people want. They can personalize these campaigns to them at scale, and it works, and they're growing hugely. And I don't want to undermine or belittle what they've done. It's incredible, but it's almost by accident that they found themselves doing this. By protecting that brand so much and building out that CRM, they've actually done a brilliant job. They've positioned themselves amazingly for this new paradigm. So how can you improve how you capture data about your individual customers? How is your profiling going in terms of building out those profiles for your target customers? A lot of brands tended to, I think that the trend has changed now, but everybody was trying to get people to buy direct because they were able to maintain margin, they were able to learn more about those individual users, they were able to cross-sell and upsell. But what's happened now is where users have the control in this new non-linear purchasing path is that brands must engage the users where they are. So rather than forcing people onto a buy direct or a direct to consumer store, how can you as a brand take that user attention wherever it is, be it on Facebook, be it on your website, be it on a campaign page, an advertisement, wherever that attention is, because remember, the user may develop this buying intent anywhere, and when it's an algorithm or a machine making that decision, you again have to make sure that you're capturing that buying intent that algorithm develops for your product wherever that happens, and making sure that you can funnel that through to a purchasing event. So making sure that you can engage the users wherever they are, wherever they want to be, maybe that's Instagram, Snapchat, Facebook, the web, wherever, and then driving that through to a conversion opportunity. Creating unique brand experiences. So we saw the personalized video. Creating personalized experiences at scale is now possible. It's not a case of blasting out different ads and targeting them wildly. How can you create unique brand experiences for an individual to make them feel genuinely engaged? So look at the Instagram influencer phenomenon, where an individual, a 15-year-old, can go in, create a personality online, have a million followers, and build a brand worth millions in a few months. How does a traditional brand like P&G or Unilever compete with that type of user engagement, where the user feels so genuinely connected to the individual because they can see that the individual has passion, a genuine passion for their product? They feel that they can connect and talk to that individual. How does a P&G create that kind of experience, that kind of passion? And the answer is, it's very difficult. So how can you create an experience where the user feels that they have that connection with your brand? Because again, if you connect this back to where we're trying to go with this, which is, if a robot is making the decisions, if it thinks that you have a relationship with that brand and you appreciate that brand and you again are going to want that brand because the algorithm is trying to please you, not the brand, it's trying to please you as an individual. So if you can create an experience where the individuals feel connected to that brand, then the algorithms are more likely to recommend your brand to the user. Does that all make sense? Does anybody have any questions at this stage? So making every interaction shoppable. So this kind of connects back with some of the previous ones as well. So how do you take the user attention, and where are you driving it to? So if you look at some of the campaigns that I've studied, hundreds of them, but if you look at these campaigns that are driving people through to largely nothing, a follow on Facebook, no real direct, passionate engagement with that user. They're just driving it through to a kind of a non-event. Making everything actionable and understanding, based on the profile of that user, what call to action is appropriate for that user. So maybe the call to action of learn more is much more appropriate than buy now, or download a coupon. Or maybe you've already bought the products that are most relevant to, that you're advertising, but you want to capture a cross-sell opportunity or an upsell opportunity, or you want to build that relationship to become more meaningful with your brand. How can you do that? And it's only by using technology like channel sites, but you know, you can see the kind of reason I'm here. But but it's only by actually making those interactions shoppable or actionable, and that's why we feel our technology is so compelling, because it's enabling that you to take everything that you've built, the value that you've built, in understanding the profile, in understanding what that user is going to want to do, and then driving that through to a conversion and ultimately, hopefully, loyalty and repeat purchases. So understanding user behavior is, there's many ways to interpret that, but once you have a profile built, you understand who you're targeting, you understand what they're doing, you're driving that loyalty, you're making every engagement actionable so you can see what's working to drive that engagement, what isn't. You're creating unique experiences and you're testing those so that you can see if an individual profile of a user is engaging with that, then you can double down on it. If it's not working, you can discontinue it and reallocate that budget elsewhere. But once you're doing all that, tracking the behavior and making sure that you're modifying what you're doing based on the engagements that are happening is absolutely essential, because that's the only way you can maximize the return on investment. And again, thinking about what we're doing here, trying to influence algorithms, it's only through understanding how the user is behaving, because ultimately it's going to be the user's behavior that is going to be emulated by these algorithms. And then lasting relationships. I mean, that's been the thread through this entire thing. If you don't build a relationship with your user, if they don't genuinely feel this connection, and they're not asking for Duracell batteries, I want to buy Duracell batteries. Alexa wouldn't have said, I can't find anything else, if they'd asked for Duracell. How do you make the person ask for your brand? Or failing that, make sure that the algorithm recognizes that your brand is a fit for that user, so it recommends it to you. And it's only by developing those relationships that you can do this. The innovation is kind of it's almost, I said six or seven, because embracing innovation is almost a kind of a no-brainer that everybody should be doing. It's brands like Friesen Campina and Frico Cheese who are taking these kind of ideas and bringing these through to an actual project that is validated and that is actually working. And there is a number of strategic objectives and targets that they have taken out of that plan and that project that are now feeding into what they're actually doing every day. So it's only by knowing that you're going to fail at lots of things, 90% failure rate for startup businesses, if you take that mentality, and Bonin made that an absolute core part of what he was doing in Mondelez, for example. And we worked with Bonin in Mondelez to create campaigns from nothing and do an awful lot of test and learns to establish that. And if you look at some of the things that came out of that, the Oreo campaigns at the Super Bowl, these were all these the customized Oreos. All of these type of campaigns that Oreo created, maybe 90% of them might have failed, but it's the 10% that were successful that you and everybody knows about. But if you're not willing to take that risk and assign budget accordingly, you're never going to get anywhere. So that's the summary of the of how to create that influencing influence with the algorithms. So has anybody got any questions at this point?
So, John, the way we handle questions is we're going to walk around with the mic, and whoever wants to go first.
I'm not quite finished. I can go on.
Oh, okay.
Bonin is obviously still stuck
okay.
in this.
I still want to use the mic for any questions, so we can capture it on audio. Anybody have any questions right now?
With regard to the relationship in terms of the number six, building lasting relationships, as opposed to acquisition, like how do you see things flowing? Like how much of the energy needs to be spent on the acquisition side and how much on the retention side in your opinion?
Well, I think how much on retention versus how much on acquisition was the key question there, right? I think there's two different things here. First of all, when you have this where we're talking about influencing algorithms, this is a new type of acquisition. You're trying to acquire customers by acquiring their algorithms or the recommendations of their algorithms. So in that respect, if you acquire the user and that sale, then hopefully you're going to retain them, because what happens with online shopping, particularly grocery, you buy it once, it tends to stay in your basket. Unless you don't like it, you remove it again. So it's about creating that initial sale. If the algorithm makes a purchase for you and you don't like it, you have to actively say, and don't buy that brand from me again. So I think the absolute focus at this point, because this is still a relatively immature stage that this is at, the first focus has to be on acquisition and refining everything that you're doing to ensure that it's aligning with the overall plan of acquiring as many sales as you can through this emerging new channel. Retention then is kind of, it falls, they're already in your CRM, if you like. Again, think of Nespresso. They're already in your CRM. Did they like that product? You can test them, you can ask them, did they buy it twice? Did they keep on buying it? Did they remove it? So retention is almost it falls into the existing policy for how you retain and cross-sell and upsell to those customers. So I think this is about acquisition, but making sure you're acquiring the right type of people and then learning about, as much as you can about them as they move through that kind of relationship with you. Does that make sense? So what do we do then? So we've absolutely optimized everything that we're doing so that all of the algorithms are recommending the right type of batteries to me based on who I am. It's working at scale. What do you do then? It's automation, right? So if you have, if you're advertising, if you're pushing out campaigns and they're advertising to algorithms and those algorithms are buying your products, you want to automate that. So then you have the kind of bizarre situation where you're programmatically buying campaigns and the algorithms are, the user is never engaged with them. They're just, the products are arriving at their door. So you have robots advertising to robots and you're just consuming the stuff. Kind of completely disconnected from the entire process, unless the algorithm makes a mistake or buys recommends something that isn't quite to your liking. So it's kind of crazy how that's actually happening, and you're actually going to have just robots advertising to robots. So I suppose the core message here is that change is coming. Change is here. We've developed it. Friesen Campina is one example. There's dozens of other companies that we've worked with to create these kind of innovation projects. So how is your brand specifically going to take those kind of seven pieces of tips, for want of a better word, to double down on what you're doing to position yourselves to be able to advertise to those algorithms as they start buying more and more of your product? I think that speaks for itself, really. This is not about individual unique relationships anymore, where you are talking individually to a user. That user is going to think that that's exactly what's happening if you're doing it well. So it's building that relationship and managing that relationship and making sure that you're doing that in a seamless way that the user doesn't even know that it's not a specific campaign or a relationship that you've tried to build just with them. So that's the end of my presentation. I'm not sure if Bonin has arrived yet, but I'm happy to take any questions.
He's soloing, John?
So I'm still up here. He sent me two text messages. Okay.
Did your bot read it for you? And
what's that?
Did your bot read it for you?
No, yeah. I'm reading that myself. So he's still downtown. So he's not going to make it. But I am happy to try and answer any questions that I can.
Okay, we've got one over here.
If anybody has any.
Hi. You spoke about how everything's changing and we're moving towards a world of AI, essentially. Do you see in the world of AI that personal relationships disappear?
No, if you go back to what I was saying about the influencer kind of brands that are popping up on Instagram and other platforms, I think personalization is key, but that personal relationship is what you're trying to create. It's the absolute objective. If you look at how those influencer brands are coming into existence, it's only through that feeling that users have of that genuine passion that they get from the person they're following on Instagram, that feeling that they can relate to them, that they're the same as them, and that's how they're growing so quickly. So what are you, the key is, as a large brand, how do you emulate that at scale? So you can't, realistically, your CEO isn't going to go online and build a relationship with 50 million people. As much as you might like them to, it's too difficult to do. So it's just not possible to do it at scale. And if you don't have some kind of strategy to manage this kind of relationship building using automation, using artificial intelligence, using machine learning, and experimentation to build out the profile of the person you're targeting, to understand how to engage with them, to give them the right call to action at the right time, and to drive them through to a conversion, and ultimately to try and build that relationship and drive that loyalty and engagement over time, over the long term. So it's absolutely about building personal relationships, but how do you do that in an environment where you can't possibly manage that number of relationships? And that's key. Bearing in mind that ultimately, if you don't do it well, the algorithms are just going to pretend you don't exist because they don't feel that they're relevant to the person they represent. Does that make sense?
Other questions?
Thank you for your presentation. Question on larger ticket items, automotive, home buying.
Sorry, I missed you there. I got the thank you. I was obviously still in a
question on larger ticket items, longer purchasing cycles,
yeah.
Cars, homes, things like that. How is this going to affect that side of retail?
Well, I think that this is absolutely relevant for the long term. And I think the advantage that you have is you have more time to develop that relationship. The disadvantage is you don't really know if it's working until they buy or they don't buy, and that if that takes 5 years or 2 years, then you've got that longer test cycle. But fundamentally, what can you do? You have to do as many tests as you can. You have to try and capture as much data as you possibly can. If you're building out the profile for the user, what are you doing to ensure that that's done with as much flexibility for mistakes that you might be making as possible, so that they're built in? How can you run test and learn campaigns when you have that longer buying cycle? So it's about doing this, but doing it in a way that fits with your business model. But it's absolutely relevant.
Other questions? All right, I'm going to get one in, John. We have a room full of marketers. You want to comment on the impact on the marketing profession impacted by AI?
Well. Yeah, I mean, nobody's gonna have a job in 5 years. No, I'm not saying that, right? But how people are going to be required to engage with this is definitely going to change. Where you have algorithms making the decisions for users, the question becomes the topic of the presentation, how do we advertise to an algorithm? Once that's automated, you are automating programmatic campaigns right now. So that is still going to be required. There's going to be a lot of evolution, and the type of work that people will be doing will be different, and it will be focused on how do we personalize these relationships, how do we implement CRMs that are clever and learning, using machine learning to update our profiles of these users. So it's going to be very different in terms of, rather than even look 10 years ago about television slots. I think, is it just in the last couple of months that they've discontinued the 30-second ad slot over here on television, because people just don't have that attention span anymore. And if you look at one of the things that we're doing, say, with broadcast networks, is we're changing how people engage with those. So 41% of people over the next year are expected to either cut or shave the cord. So if they're reducing the consumption of advertising and television, traditional television, so much, what can TV networks who rely on that revenue do differently? And one of those things, so even if you look at Netflix, you pay a small monthly subscription fee and you have zero advertisements. It's compelling for people. And that's why this switchover is so great. What can traditional networks do to compete with that? So what one thing that we have developed is for broadcast networks to be able to make television and content shoppable. So you're watching a show, you pause that show and you can buy the shirt that the guy's wearing, or you can buy the car that he's driving. And so rather than an advertisement, which is 30 seconds, and again, it might be for bleach, you don't want to have your show or your film interrupted so you can learn about bleach. It's just nobody does, right? I don't think there's anybody has ever said, you know what, I'd love to learn about bleach right now, right? In the middle of the climax of a movie. So, you know, that is why people are cutting the cord. So what can they do? If you knew that guy who's just about to be shot and the climax of the film, but his car is really nice, I'm actually just gonna click. I wanna learn more about that later on, and you can just press one button and it's done. It's making content shoppable. That's a compelling reason for people to continue to engage with that content. So you're not seeing a 30-second ad, but you are buying products still. So you're generating revenue. A DIY show might be sponsored by Black & Decker, or by a retailer that you can buy all of the tools that were featured in this show. So these are more changes, and these again are going to be powered with connected devices, with voice commerce. This is all coming together in kind of a grand unifying vision. But that is how that's coming together.
Thank you. Question over here.
Do you have a favorite example of teaching AI to shop your preference, like on an individual level? Is there like an example where you taught Alexa or whoever to buy what you wanted to buy instead of what she wanted to pitch to you?
My favorite example is of showing how it works is the Scott Galloway with the batteries. I don't shop using Alexa myself, and I live in Ireland, and we don't have the ability to just buy direct yet. It hasn't been enabled yet. So I've seen it work. I've used it many times, but I don't personally use it myself. So there is a profile for me. Amazon has a profile for every one of us. If you've ever bought anything on Amazon, and it depends how mature that is. Amazon Prime is only just launching in Ireland, so we're slightly behind the times a little bit on that. But there's only 4 million of us, so you got to understand why they do it that way. But in short answer, I don't have a personal preference. Sorry about that.
All right, we have time for one more question. Behind me, in front of me, in the back. Figured it would be all the way in the back.
Keep you fit running around the place.
So the greater population, not us in the marketing world as much, but the greater population thinks about AI and they start having these thoughts about Terminator Judgment Day, right? There's this great degree of fear that comes along with the concept of it. But in the marketing world, there is some concern as well, the idea of the data that is being collected all over the place. There's some thought, and I've seen this done, where Alexa is always on, and even though it's not responding to you, it's still recording things. And in fact, on the app, you can actually see a recording of everything that you've told Alexa. How deep does this data dump go? Where do you think it's going? And should we be concerned about the Terminator?
So a lot of questions there. You can see, I showed you a video of where Terminator's at right now. So for today, we're okay. But my personal view is, if you look at the debates going on between the likes of Elon Musk and Bill Gates and Mark Zuckerberg about, is AI going to eventually kill us? My own view, personally, is that I think it is a dangerous technology and it does need to be regulated because it will ultimately become self-aware, just like Terminator 2, Judgment Day, and I think that that is a genuinely serious threat. So that's my personal view. That's not something that we need to worry about in 5 years, but is it something that we need to worry about in 50? And I believe it is. Now, leaving that aside, what can we do with AI now? Is that, sorry, what was the other part of your question? I got so carried away with dying.
Completely understandable. No, the part of my question is that the fact that these devices right now are constantly recording.
Oh, sorry, yeah. So all of this content is being recorded. You're being recorded. You have an argument with your wife, and it's in some computer database somewhere, even though you weren't talking to Alexa. I think there's a very different opinion towards that in the U.S. versus Europe. So you have in Europe, you have GDPR. It's a data protection and data privacy legislation coming down the road, and that is going to have a very big impact for companies like Facebook, Amazon, Apple, all of these companies who are capturing data, even Samsung with smart TVs, pushing content off the device to the internet for analysis. And again, personally, I don't like the idea of it. I don't agree with the idea. If you've got nothing to hide, you should have. You should have nothing to fear about your data being completely and widely available. I think that is a misguided view, because I think it only takes a change of government policy for what something that wasn't previously wrong to become wrong, and then all of a sudden you're a criminal, and they have lots of records about you being a criminal. So I think being able to specify that you have not you want to use these services and that you want your data to be retained and you want it to be available to be used in this way is very valuable, and some people will opt for it. Others will have a more conservative view over what they want their data to be used for. And what's happening in Europe is that is becoming punishable with massive, massive fines, and if companies are not compliant, and it is going to have a very big impact for these companies like Facebook. In the US, I think the kind of attitude has always been slightly different, which is the data is generally available, and it is more difficult to lock down that data. I believe there will be a pushback on that. I think these tech companies, who are so integral to everything that we do, it is going to reach a tipping point with data breaches, with various different identity theft incidents, and this kind of thing, where it reaches a tipping point where people say, okay, well, that's not good enough now. We need to implement standards and manage this more effectively, so that if I want to be private, if I don't want every single interaction I've ever had online to be available for a company to market to me on the basis of, then I have the right to do that. So that's where I believe, I believe will happen in the U.S. as well, to a certain, although lesser degree, to Europe.
Thank you, John. Well, tell Bonin that we missed him.
I will. I'll send him a photo of you guys. I pass on his apologies on his behalf, and I'm sorry he didn't make it, but hopefully you found this in some way interesting.
Absolutely. Thank you, John. Let's give it up for John Beckett.
Cheers.